Hi, I'm Chinny.
And I'm Astrid.
And welcome to It's a Continent, the podcast that widens access to African history. We're also the co-authors of the book by the same name. You can find out more information about us on itsacontinent.com. So we're here to challenge the common misconception that Africa is a country and appreciate the identity of each nation. And through each episode, we'll be exploring key historical moments which have shaped the continent. Hello, and welcome to another episode of It's a Continent, the last one of the season.
Last one of the season. We actually made it through.
We did it, Joe. We did it.
We did it. Yeah, no, honestly, I think, yeah, it's been good. Because actually, this one we started at the, I think this is the, I can't remember one when we've done like half the previous year and then come through a new year, but still carrying on. But I think that's why we normally start with like a new season with a new year. But we carried on. We've completed it. We are completing it today. How are we doing?
It is what it is.
Honestly, I have no words for this week. I don't even know how to describe it. It's happening, but
yeah, we're surviving.
We're carrying on.
Yeah.
So this week, would you like to know where we're going? You probably know this, obviously, by the fact that it says it on the It'll probably say it on the title of this. I don't know why we always say that, like, that it's going to be a huge surprise. It'll be like,
you know what? It's never occurred to me that people just read the title and know where we
go. I know, yeah. I just thought about it and I was like, but it says it on the title. But anyways, just in case you clicked on this by accident and wondering why these two women are having a bit of a natter, what we do. So we are going to South Africa. Well,
I wish history. I was, but
yeah, I was gonna say. We're visiting South Africa through history. We're going back, actually. This is a revisit, and we will be looking at today the life of Chief Albert John Mvumbi Luthuli, the first African to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He was recognized with this honor in 1960 for his non-violent struggle against apartheid.
It's just very interesting because this man was given the first African to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, but no shade, but I hadn't actually heard of him before.
I know. This is why we do this.
There's just so much more to South African history than certain person.
Yeah, no, honestly, because when I was reading and I was like, I feel terrible, but I have never heard of this guy's name. But yeah, we will be getting familiar with Albert Luthuli through this episode. So we'll look at how he became one of the most prominent political figures in South Africa's history. But before we get into that, here's a little bit of, we go back to beginning. We start from day dot. So Luthuli was born in southern Rhodesia, which today is modern-day Zimbabwe, in 1898. He was the youngest of three children, and sadly, his family experienced significant loss early on. His parents lost their second child, Lutuli's brother, and then his father passed away when Luthuli was only 6 months old. This left his mother to raise the children. And after spending some time in Zimbabwe, the family made the decision to move back to South Africa in 1908. Age 10, Luthuli was sent to live with his uncle Martin, who was chief of Grattville and co-founder of the South African Native National Congress. This organization later became the African National Congress, the ANC, which played a pivotal role in the fight against apartheid. And the organization is also kind of a key to Albert's story as well. Whilst living with his uncle Martin, exposed Albert to his Zulu culture, tradition, and South Africa's politics. He was also sent to school by his mother. And in his autobiography, Let My People Go, which I definitely recommend.
That is a cracking title. Absolutely.
Not just based on the title, but honestly, I've been reading, as I was doing research for this, reading this on my Kindle. Yes, it's available on Kindle. This is not an ad, by the way. Sorry, I'm sounding like such a walking advert.
It's not an ad.
But yeah, I definitely recommend getting his autobiography and reading through it. It is, yeah, it's incredible just hearing it from through his own words. In his autobiography, he recognized his mother's efforts in ensuring he received an education. He reflects on how his mother was a very successful vegetable gardener. However, in addition to her work on her fields, the lack of ready cash in the family and the lack of capital to work the whole land basically forced her to walk regularly 5 to 6 miles to the nearest European settlement in order to earn a few shillings washing clothes. She honestly just sounds like such an incredible woman, and she was so just determined to make sure that her boys were brought up well and had an education. So yeah, shout out to the mums. As he grew up, Luthuli developed a keen interest in teaching and pursued a career in education. He completed his teacher training, specializing in teaching Zulu and music at Adams College, and would also train future teachers. Around this time, he also met his future wife, Nokukanya Bengu, in 1925. They tied the knot 2 years later and went on to have 7 children. The family were devout Christians, and Luthuli was very much about giving everyone in the family a voice. His eldest daughter recalled how he would never impose his status as family head upon us. Everybody had an equal opportunity to talk, and no one was considered too young to have his views respected. I think that element of Christianity and faith is something, as we tell more of his story, that you see kind of come through. It plays a really important role in his life and in his story.
Definitely. And I love the fact that, like, even within his own family, he modeled that vision of how he wanted society to be. So that's really great example there from Luthuli. The political situation saw apartheid well and truly take hold. Apartheid was a system of racial segregation and discrimination that was enforced in South Africa from 1948 to 1994 and resulted in the oppression of non-white South Africans across various areas, including education, healthcare, and politics. Some examples of legislations introduced at the time included things like 1892 Franchise and Ballot Act, which limited Africans' ability to vote based on financial and educational qualifications, the 1949 Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act, and the 1950 Immorality Act, which made marriage and sexual relations between white people and other racial groups illegal. All of these laws were designed to maintain and reinforce white supremacy. Back in Groutville, its residents encouraged Luthuli to run for the position of chief in the upcoming elections, a role previously held by his uncle Martin in the 1920s. Initially, Luthuli was hesitant to apply for the job for several reasons. Firstly, it meant leaving his beloved teaching career. Secondly, he felt he lacked sufficient experience to govern.
Literally, we are the same person, Chini, because I thought the same thing when I read.
He felt that way. It's a shame that not everybody feels.
Guys, we are not all meant. Let's all accept not all of. We are not all born to
it's
be.
Not,
leading.
Sometimes it's sometimes it's not our calling. You just have to accept it.
Sometimes your only calling is to lead your own life and to lead yourself. You know what I mean?
Line manage yourself.
Line manage yourself. Let's really advocating for putting that on the CV. I line manage myself. Do you know what I mean? Let's not be trying to take care
let's
of the whole
that
community.
Pride.
Yes. Own it, people.
Another reason that Luthuli was hesitant to apply for the job was because his family would experience financial hardship since the chief's salary was only 20% of what he earned as a teacher. Eventually, Luthuli agreed to put himself in the running and was elected chief of Groutville in 1936. In his autobiography, he describes the multifaceted nature of the chief's role, including being an administrator, overseeing the daily affairs of 5,000 people living on 10,000 acres, acting as a magistrate for civil issues, and serving as the chief of police responsible for maintaining order in his territory. As chief, he also had to enforce apartheid laws and policies, such as the Land Acts, which introduced policies like forcing Africans to sell excess cattle at reduced rates to white farmers. Luthuli remained committed to governing with integrity. This was against a prevalent narrative at the time, which suggested that African poverty was due to their supposed inefficient agricultural techniques rather than inadequate land distribution. He did his best to ensure fair and just leadership despite these challenges.
I think one of the things that I really felt for him in his story is the fact that he was so, he had this, he wanted to do the right thing, and you could really sense that. But also he was in a really challenging situation where he's being put in positions whereby he's doing things that he also disagrees with, or having to implement things that he always also disagrees with. So you're sort of being forced into hypocrisy in a sense, but he really made the effort to try and do things the right way and make sure that it was fair. But he wasn't a, you know, as chief, he wasn't a...
It's a difficult situation. Yeah.
And another thing I wanted to share is that he also mentions how some chiefs, they were sort of in place there as like, I think we've used this word before, but like puppets, or they would use that to, you know, they would accept bribes, that kind of thing. So, you know, there was a lot of challenges. And also when you're seeing that you're earning like 20% of what you previously earned, there's a lot of temptation there. But to really have as tried his best to maintain his integrity and lead in that way was, I think, really commendable. In 1945, Luthuli joined the African National Congress, the ANC, contributing to its efforts to end apartheid. The organization's approach at the time, which Luthuli embraced, involved taking non-violent measures to deliver change. In May 1951, he became the president of the NATO branch of the ANC, while continuing to serve as chief of Grattville. The government viewed his dual roles as a threat and demanded that he choose one. Leaving him, basically, they gave him that option, but they basically removed the role as chief from him, basically. But despite this setback, Luthuli continued to work with the ANC and was elected as its president a year later in 1952. The unpaid position made it necessary for his wife, Nkokanya, to be the sole family breadwinner, and she also supported the ANC by leading its women's league. With the situation worsening, and the ANC Youth League, of which Nelson Mandela was a member of, pushing for more forceful strategies. This approach was ultimately adopted, resulting in several strikes and boycotts taking place. During his term, one of the noteworthy actions taken by the ANC and other similar organizations was the Defiance Campaign, launched on the 26th of June 1952. The date became a day of national protest and mourning. The Defiance Campaign was a major mobilization effort against apartheid law, which saw people from different racial backgrounds come together in non-violent protest. The campaign led to the imprisonment of more than 8,000 people for various reasons, including breaking curfew, which was imposed on Africans, and entering areas designated for a specific race. The police resorted to violence, firing at the protesters and their supporters, and the campaign significantly boosted the presence of the ANC, with its members increasing from 25,000 in 1951 to around 100,000 by 1953. Once again, this placed Luthuli under the spotlight, and the government retaliated by confining him to Grattville and its surrounding districts, preventing him from attending political events, giving speeches, and visiting ANC branches. They accused him of promoting hostility between the European and non-European inhabitants, which to me is just wild. How can you see that as hostility when you have a whole segregation system in place?
So they literally are upholding that law themselves and created that law. So
law themselves, yeah.
It's like one man is not responsible for.
It's not, yeah. It just, I don't know where they got that from, but hey, that was how they saw it at the time.
During his leadership, another significant milestone was the creation of the Freedom Charter, which Luthuli viewed as a South African version of the Declaration of Human Rights. The charter laid out fundamental rights for all South Africans, including the right to own land, vote, hold political office, and have full economic and educational rights. But how could Luthuli achieve these things despite the government restrictions on his movements? Well, he relied on the help of his Indian friends, as they weren't monitored as closely as Africans. With their support, he could host and attend meetings in their home. You know, the typical sort of online discourse around allyship, but actually this is a really good example.
Example, yeah. You don't want to stop, but no, it definitely is a good example.
really good example. It's just a shame that not all skin folk are kinfolk. I'm looking at certain members of parliament, but you know, it's fine. Oh, another thing actually I was going to say around the help of his Indian friends is quite interesting that they made that decision to help him as well, because one thing that the British Empire kind of left as a bit of a remnant was around how they used Indian people as a sort of intermediary between black people and white people, kind of do a bit of their colonial bidding. And this is seen in places like Eastern Africa, and also I guess in some degree it could be said to have occurred in South Africa as well, but it's just good that it's quite interesting as well that Luthuli managed to gather the support of this group of people.
Yeah, and he had support also like across the world, so like the likes of Martin Luther King Jr. supported him, like they were around the same time, and so he did have support from various groups. And I think it's just good to see that, you know, they were also putting themselves at risk, but they still, by having that support, he was able to carry on doing the work that was that desperately needed to be done.
Definitely. So what was the response of the government to the Freedom Charter? Well, they decided to charge Luthuli and 155 other activists with high treason. By 1961, all those charged were found not guilty and were acquitted. Luthuli was again limited to Groutville and prevented from engaging in the ANC. Although Luthuli continued to reiterate the ANC's non-violent approach to ending apartheid, other members of the organisation, like Nelson Mandela, began to question the effectiveness of this approach.
Yeah, I think you can really see that, you know, they started off with kind of thinking, okay, if we raise it, we do strikes, okay, we've attempted strikes and boycotts, nothing is changing. There's definitely also probably like a, at this point, a sense of frustration as nothing is really changing. The situation is sort of, is seems to just be getting worse. Is there anything more we can, you know, we can do
for there to kind of be a change in the way of thinking, or to challenge this way of thinking? And this could be seen through the Sharpeville massacre. So this took place in March 1960, and it marked a significant turning point. At a time when decolonization was happening in various African nations, rather than embracing it, the South African government concentrated on enshrining laws that maintained apartheid. The massacre occurred in the town of Sharpeville and saw a group of more than 10,000 protesters gathered to oppose these laws, but the authorities reacted by opening fire, resulting in the death of 69 unarmed protesters and more than 180 people injured. There's always a heavy-handed response to these kind of protests.
Yeah.
It's just to remind them where the power lies, you know, because to make an example and say, well, you might think that the rest of, you know, the other Africans are gaining independence, but it's clearly a message from this government saying that that's not going to be the case.
Yeah, it's definitely not going to happen here.
And they had apartheid for at least another 30 years.
And it must have been a struggle, especially at the time, for those who, you know, you are seeing other nations around you going through decolonization. Yeah. And your situation just seems to be getting worse. And there doesn't seem to be a point of, I don't want to, I think resolution is definitely not the point of this call, but there doesn't seem to be a kind of light at the end of all of this. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't seem to be escapable in a sense. And as conditions in South Africa continue to deteriorate, Nelson Mandela and other ANC group members began advocating for a different strategy, one that involved armed resistance. The ANC convened to discuss this new approach, and while Luthuli remained against it, he understood the reasoning behind it. They ultimately agreed to establish a separate military wing of the ANC, known as MK. MK is the abbreviation because I was going to struggle with the actual pronunciation.
No, we don't want to.
Yes. But it basically means kind of spear of the nation. The plan was for the ANC to maintain its non-violent stance while MK pursued more aggressive tactics. MK mobilized, launching attacks and declaring that they would no longer only rely on non-violent resistance in response to the government's policies of force, suppression, and violence. Lutuli empathized with the decision to turn to violence, acknowledging that after years of non-violent resistance, people could no longer see a way forward except through fighting. And in a sense, he couldn't blame them either. So I think this is a point that you find in his story, as I said, like, is again similar to what he experienced as chief, whereby you're wanting to support your community, but then you're also having to deal with the apartheid system. Here you've got, you know, he's trying to deliver change, but in a way that is authentic and aligned to his faith and how he thinks it should be done, but also realizing that they've been doing this for so long in this way and nothing is changing, and also taking on that feeling of, you know, people are frustrated, so what do we do? To be honest, I don't see another way they could have done it, in a sense, than having this other branch as well that supported supported attacks, but, you know, was able to give them a sense of, we can do something to defend ourselves.
As Martin Luther King Jr. said, a riot is the language of the unheard. So, you know, this is the next stage. If the government is not listening to you or giving into your or listening to your demands, then this is the only way. If you don't have any power, then this is the only thing that you can do. We've seen that strikes are a very popular concept right now.
I've got a calendar to tell me who is striking on which days, because you can't keep up. I'm all for it, but I just need to keep it in my diary.
We just need to know what's going on.
But,
you know, in the case of the striking workers, they can withhold their labor because that is their power. But
yeah,
what can you do if you don't have any power? This is the only thing that you can do. So, and besides, even when you are non-violent, then the government are violent towards you. So
towards you, yeah.
What, and then they're like, oh well, you know, we want peaceful protests, but they're not peaceful. Mm-hmm. So
it basically just puts you in this, like, in the middle, and you're like, what? Yeah. So I do think it was, in a sense, if they won't be listened to, as you said, yeah, it was necessary for them to move in this direction.
And in 1962, the government expanded the definition of sabotage to include labor strikes. There we go.
Mm-hmm.
And political graffiti.
Imagine political graffiti.
If found guilty of sabotage, individuals could receive a death sentence for political graffiti.
Mm.
For going on strike, for withholding your labor.
Honestly. Some of these, like, there were so many. I know we've captured some of the acts and kind of policies, but just, like, how was this okay?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it wasn't okay, but it was just able.
It was legal, right? So this is the thing. This is the problem with using legality as a way of saying, oh, well, it must have been okay because it was legal. A lot of things, once put in law, technically it was legal, but surely this is just repressing human rights. The apartheid system and its laws further isolated Luthuli. He was basically under house arrest, which prevented him from doing his work with the ANC. And the ANC itself also had to reconsider how it maintained its presence. Also, Luthuli was not doing well health-wise, as he'd suffered from a heart attack and a stroke years earlier, and he was partially blind and hard of hearing.
I do think as well that, like, I just have this feeling of just, like, thinking about just how long he'd kept going for and the situation his family were in. You know, he had 7 children and he's doing this work which doesn't really pay. And gosh, I don't know. I just have this sense of, like, exhaustion, but also wanting to keep the fight and maintaining that fight and constantly wanting to be like, no, we still have to keep going. I guess it's when you're in those, just a level of, determination and perseverance is, for me, just incredible.
On July the 21st, 1967, Luthuli passed away after being struck by a train. Whilst the official inquest suggested that his poor eyesight and hearing were to blame, those close to him doubted this explanation, especially as the government was known to use violent tactics against opposition figures. That's quite a scary thought, because Luthuli had already won the Nobel Peace Prize at this point.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering if there was a sense of, like, because the number of times, honestly, I can recall reading that he was like, okay, his movements are limited to Groutsville. He's, you know, he can't go anywhere.
Where's he going? Yeah.
He can't go anywhere. But again, he was still making noise and he was still you know, in their faces, and he still had a presence, but he was still limited. Do you see what I mean? Like, there was...
He was still limited, but they were still threatened by him even through his limitations.
They were still threatened by him, which for me is just wild. Well, you guys can have all of these acts and policies or whatever, but this man is going to find a way to be heard and push through regardless of that.
Quite sad to see, because it's quite similar to Steve Biko's story and how his life was also cut short through the work of you know, the apartheid government, claiming that, oh, it was just another cause of death, which is really highly suspicious here. I mean, this person has suffered, you know, a heart attack, stroke, is not doing well health-wise. The story is not making sense.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't add up. And I think this is the challenge with a lot of these leaders who had were so prominent in kind of like the history of their nations, that there's no explanation, right? Like,
no,
there's always, it's all in secret and nobody really knows the truth. And yeah, orbit can actually truly believe that the truth that we have been told of the version of it is actually what occurred, because there were things going on. Yeah.
No, definitely, definitely. Well, it's a bit of a downer, no, but
but I do think he was still it's definitely a worthwhile person to get. It wasn't.
We need to celebrate him. We need to celebrate the work of Luthuli and, you know, highlight what he's done and how actually maybe we kind of think about how apartheid was not a one-man struggle. I'm not like throwing shade, but it's just because it's presented sometimes, but there were just multiple people that were involved in this fight.
Definitely. And I think there was a quote someone, I can't remember when I was reading, they were like, Luthuli was Mandela before Mandela. And you can see they worked, you know,
They worked together.
Yeah. They were closely involved. They had their own journeys into it and stuff, but they worked together. And so I do think that he definitely supported in.
Oh, 100%. Because Mandela, thankfully, was able to live to kind of see the end of apartheid, unlike many others who died before him in the process.
But yeah, that is us done. The end of season 6.
Yes.
End of season 6. Oh my. Every time we say it's like the end of the season, I'm like, wow, we've really been doing this.
We've really been out here, you know.
We've really been out here.
The pandemic was a while ago now.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. Honestly, thank you so much for listening as always. Keep sharing, liking, sending us recommendations.
Please do, because we're going to start planning season 7, which is wild. But yes, we do love all your suggestions. So do
keep sending it. I also just wanted to shout out to the schools that have reached out to us and people that have reached out to us. If you are interested or want to kind of collaborate with us, please do reach out and email us, or reach out to us on our social medias. Yeah, please do get in contact, because we do love talking about and bringing to light these stories of incredible people who really we should have known about, and now I know and then I can say. Yeah,
so you can follow us on Twitter at It's a Continent, and also on Instagram at It's a Continent Pod. Our website is itsacontinent.com, and you can also contact us and through that as well. So yeah, we look forward to hearing from you all. Thank you for listening, and thank you all for your support this season.
Thank you for listening.
We'll see you guys. Bye.
Bye.